Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
In February of 1959, a group of 9 hikers set out across the northern Ural Mountains in the Soviet Union. This was a planned winter expedition, officially registered, carefully documented, and led by a 23-year-old engineering student named Igor Dyatlov. The group carried permits, cameras, journals, and enough experience to qualify for the highest certification available at the time. On paper, this was the kind of trip that happened often and ended quietly. They were expected back within weeks. When that return window passed without word, concern followed quickly. The group had agreed to send a telegram once they completed the route, but nothing arrived. Days passed. Then more days. Only after the delay could no longer be explained away did search efforts begin. When teams eventually reached the area, the expedition had ended, but not in a way that matched the conditions around it. The hiker's tent was found abandoned on an exposed slope, cut open from the inside. Most of their clothing and supplies were still inside. The bodies were scattered across the landscape, some far from the campsite, some dressed for sleep rather than survival. Some carrying injuries that didn't align cleanly with exposure alone. What keeps this incident alive isn't that people died in extreme conditions. That happens in mountains every year. It's that what was found never settled into a single explanation, even after an official investigation closed the case. The facts themselves stayed narrow and specific. What grew over time was everything built around them. In this episode, we're going to slow the timeline back down. We'll walk through who these hikers were, what they planned, what was documented along the route, what was found at the site, and which explanations were introduced afterward, separating what entered the record early from what arrived much later. To understand why this disappearance never quite resolved, you have to return to the beginning of the expedition. When you pull the timeline back far enough, the first thing that becomes clear is how ordinary this expedition was supposed to be. Igor Dyatlov wasn't a legend when the trip began. He was 23, an engineering student at the Ural Polytechnic Institute, known less for bravado than for preparation. He planned routes carefully, documented his work, and had already led winter expeditions without incident. People followed him not because he chased risk, but because he avoided surprises. The rest of the group fit that same profile. These weren't casual hikers or first-timers. They were experienced skiers and mountaineers, most in their early 20s, with prior winter travel behind them. Several had already completed routes of comparable length and difficulty. On paper, their backgrounds were unremarkable, which is usually a good thing. One member joined shortly before departure. He was older than the others and had a different life history, including military service. His inclusion was documented, approved, and not treated as unusual at the time. Whatever later interpretations made of that detail, it didn't stand out when the expedition was assembled. The objective itself was straightforward. The group planned to cross a remote stretch of the northern Urals, complete a route of roughly 300 kilometers, and return with the documentation required to qualify for a Grade 3 certification, the highest level awarded at the time for winter trekking. that classification wasn't symbolic. It required long distances, isolation, and conditions that tested planning more than courage. This was considered a difficult expedition, but a reasonable one. The terrain was known. The season was expected. The risks were understood and planned for. The equipment was selected deliberately. Supplies were accounted for. Journals and cameras weren't personal touches. They were part of the requirement. Up to this point, nothing about the trip suggested recklessness or improvisation. It looked like a group doing exactly what they were trained to do. And once the planning phase ended, the expedition shifted from preparation into motion, moving north into conditions that initially behaved exactly as anticipated. From there, the expedition unfolded the way trips like this usually do, gradually, methodically, without any sign that it was turning into something else. The group departed in late January of 1959, traveling by train and truck before switching to skis and continuing on foot. Once they left the last settlement behind, the record becomes steady and almost conversational. Journals were kept daily. Photographs were taken constantly, not posed or dramatic, just practical images meant to track distance, terrain, weather, and progress. The entries are routine. Distances covered, camps made, equipment adjusted. There are jokes in the margins and small complaints about cold fingers and heavy packs. Nothing that reads as alarm. Nothing that feels out of place now that wouldn't have felt ordinary then. The photographs support that tone. You see the group moving together, stopping to eat, pitching tents, skiing through open terrain. Visibility comes and goes. Snow deepens. Faces look tired, but they're not strained. This is a long route, and they're settling into it. As they moved farther north, conditions behaved the way winter conditions always do. Winds increased, temperatures dropped, visibility narrowed. Adjustments were made without ceremony. Routes were corrected. Camps were set when they needed to be set. On February 1st, the group reached the slope known locally as Dead Mountain. The name wasn't treated as a warning. It was just geography. That day, worsening wind and blowing snow reduced visibility enough that the group drifted off their intended path. That deviation is noted plainly in the record. Rather than descending immediately, they chose to stop and make camp on the slope. The decision is documented. So is the work that followed. Photographs show them cutting into the snow to level a platform for the tent. This wasn't improvisation, it was procedure. The final diary entry from that night is brief and unremarkable. It mentions wind. It mentions cold. It describes the work of setting camp. It reads like hundreds of entries written before it, which is part of why it still matters. Because up to this point, nothing required intervention. After that entry, the record stops moving forward. No additional journal notes, no photographs that can be placed in sequence. The steady, documented progress that marked each day simply goes quiet. And when the story resumes, it does not do so through their voices, but through absence, measured weeks later by people who expected to find tracks continuing onward, and instead found the trail ended where no ending had been planned. When search teams finally reached the area in late February, they weren't looking for a mystery. They were looking for people who were overdue. The assumption was delay, injury, maybe weather, something explainable. What they found instead was the tent. It sat partway down the slope of Kolatsiako, positioned laterally across the incline rather than tucked into a sheltered depression. That placement wasn't unusual given the visibility problems recorded the night before. It matched the conditions described in the final entry. The structure itself was still standing. Poles were upright. The fabric was intact enough to identify immediately as the group's campsite. The first fracture came when investigators looked closer. The tent had been cut open from the inside, not torn by wind, not collapsed by snow. Multiple deliberate slashes bypassed the entrance entirely. Someone inside the tent had decided that leaving through the fabric was faster than using the door they had built for that purpose. Inside, the scene moved in the opposite direction. Boots were still there. Coats were still there. Heavy outerwear, gloves, and equipment needed for travel in extreme cold sat in orderly piles. The food remained. Personal items remained. Nothing inside suggested a chaotic evacuation or a scramble for survival. Outside the tent, the ground added the next layer. Nine sets of footprints led downhill toward the tree line. They were visible, measurable, and evenly spaced. The impressions weren't deep. They didn't overlap or scatter. Some were made by boots, others by socks. A few appeared barefoot. At 30 below zero, and still the spacing didn't change. The tracks suggest walking, not running. The direction stayed consistent. There were no signs of a struggle, no sudden turns, and no indication that anyone broke away from the group. Whatever prompted them to leave the tent created urgency without disorder. That's the moment this case refuses to smooth over. The shelter was abandoned immediately, but not chaotically. The group moved together downhill toward the forest, leaving behind the very things they would have needed to survive the night. From there, the search followed those tracks away from the fabric and into the trees, where the story stopped being about where they had been and became about who didn't come back. The footprints led downhill for roughly half a mile, ending at the edge of the forest. That's where the first bodies were found. Near a large cedar tree, searchers located two of the hikers lying side by side. They were dressed lightly, no coats, no boots, minimal clothing inconsistent with both the temperature and the supplies still waiting back at the tent. Between them was evidence of a small fire built directly against a tree. The location made practical sense. It offered shelter from the wind and sat at a lower elevation than the slope. If the group was trying to regain warmth or visibility, this is where you would expect them to stop. The condition of the bodies complicated that logic. Both showed signs consistent with hypothermia. One also had burns on the hands and lower legs, likely from prolonged contact with the fire. There were no defensive injuries, no indications of a struggle. So whatever unfolded here happened after they had already left the tent and reached the trees. Moving back upslope along the same general line of travel, three more bodies were found over the following days. They were positioned between the cedar tree and the campsite, oriented as if moving back toward the tent. Their clothing was more complete than the first two, but still inadequate for the conditions. Injuries were minimal. Autopsy reports later listed hypothermia as the cause of death. At this point, five of the nine hikers had been accounted for. The remaining four were not found until May, when snowmelt exposed a ravine deeper into the forest, roughly 75 meters beyond the cedar tree. They were discovered together beneath several feet of compacted snow. Their condition did not match the others. These bodies showed significant traumatic injuries, crushed ribs, severe chest damage, skull fractures. In one case, soft tissue injuries that occurred after death, likely due to prolonged exposure and scavenging while buried. Importantly, these injuries were not accompanied by external wounds typically associated with blunt force violence. Autopsies did not list hypothermia as the primary cause of death for this group. And this contrast mattered. Some died with no visible injuries in open terrain. Others survived longer, moved farther, and died together with trauma usually associated with high-force impact. All had left the tent on the same night. All were part of the same decision to move downhill. And that combination is difficult to reduce to a single cause. By the time the last bodies were recovered, the search phase had ended. What followed was no longer about finding anyone alive. It became an attempt to explain how one night produced outcomes that looked, even on paper, like more than one kind of event. And that's where the official explanations began. Once the bodies were recovered, the search phase gave way to an investigation. Soviet authorities opened a formal inquiry into the deaths, documenting the scene, collecting testimony, and ordering autopsies. This followed the standard structure of a state investigation, with medical findings recorded, witness statements gathered, and conclusions entered into the file. The causes of death were listed individually. Several hikers were said to have died from hypothermia. Others were attributed to traumatic injuries caused by what investigators described as an overwhelming external force. In those cases, reports noted severe internal damage without corresponding external wounds. No criminal responsibility was assigned. There was no finding of assault, no indication that another group had been involved, and no charges brought forward. The investigation concluded that the hikers had died as the result of a compelling natural force which the hikers were unable to overcome. That phrasing closed the case. It did not specify what the force was. It did not explain why the tent was cut open, why the group left together, why they separated, or why injuries varied so sharply within the same night. Those questions were not resolved in the file. Within weeks, the case was officially closed. The area around the pass was restricted for a period of time. Materials connected to the investigation were classified. Some evidence was sealed. Other items were reportedly destroyed according to standard procedures of the era. For decades, access to the complete file remained limited. What remained publicly available was the conclusion, not the reasoning behind it. On paper, the investigation was finished. But in practice, it left the same problem intact. A group of experienced hikers abandoned shelter in extreme conditions, died under different circumstances, and left behind evidence that pointed in more than one direction. With the record no longer changing, attention shifted elsewhere. And once the file stopped moving, the explanations did not. Once the official investigation closed without naming a cause, the space it left didn't stay empty. At first, explanations stayed close to the mountain. One of the earliest was an avalanche. It appeared during the original investigation and resurfaced repeatedly in later reviews. The logic was straightforward. A sudden release of snow could have forced the group out of the tent quickly, without time to gather gear. It accounted for the torn shelter and the immediate departure. What it did not account for was the condition of the campsite afterward. The tent was not buried. The slope showed no clear avalanche path. Several injuries did not match burial or compression. When the explanation stalled, attention shifted to the cold itself. Exposure became the next focus. Extreme temperatures, wind, and fatigue could explain hypothermia and gradual loss of function. This fit the environment and the season. It did not explain why the tent was cut open, why some hikers left barefoot, or why others suffered severe internal injuries inconsistent with exposure alone. So when the environment alone couldn't carry the story, behavior moved to the center. Accidental departure was proposed as a way to reconcile urgency with control. Something outside the tent may have prompted the group to step out briefly, expecting to return. This aligned with the calm footprints and lack of struggle. But it did not explain why no one made it back, or why the group separated the way it did once outside. For years, the discussion stayed in that narrow band, snow, cold, judgment. Later reconstructions widened the frame. The delayed slab avalanche model was introduced decades after the case closed, proposed by researchers studying snow mechanics. It suggested the campsite itself destabilized a snow layer that collapsed hours later. This addressed timing, tent damage, and some internal injuries. But it did not account for the extended movement away from the tent, the fire site, or the survival actions that followed. When snow mechanics reached their limit, explanations turned invisible. Infrasound entered a discussion through researchers examining rare wind effects. Under specific conditions, low-frequency sound could cause disorientation or panic without a visible trigger. This explains sudden flight without an obvious threat. It did not, however, explain trauma, radiation readings, or the group's later decisions. From there, attention moved away from nature. Military testing was proposed by journalists and researchers after partial archive openings. This explanation accounted for reported lights in the sky and elevated radiation on clothing. It did not come with documentation placing the hikers inside a test zone, nor did it explain the physical layout of the scene. Radiation became its own threat once lab results were publicized. Some attributed it to prior work histories. Others linked it to events that night. It explained the readings, but it did not explain the behavior. Secret operations followed this, often tied to intelligence agencies or covert activity. These explanations addressed classification and missing materials. They did not, however, account for footprints, shelter decisions, or injury patterns. And then we have aerial phenomena, which entered later still. Reports of glowing orbs were cited from locals and later witnesses. These accounts explain nothing at the campsite itself. They persisted because the record left space. And then cryptids came last. These interpretations emerged from popular culture rather than investigation. They replaced absence with presence. They connected to no physical evidence on record. Taken together, these explanations do not resolve the disappearance. They circle it. Each one explains part of the night while leaving another untouched. Some account for environment, others for behavior, others for institutions, but none replace the missing moment when 9 people left a functioning camp and never returned. And over time, the explanations themselves became part of the case, not because they solved it, but because of how many directions the same small set of facts was pulled. When everything documented is placed back in order, the case ends where it always has, with questions that never found a place to land. Why did 9 experienced hikers cut their way out of a tent instead of using the entrance they had built for that purpose? What happened in those moments that made leaving the tent feel safer than staying inside it? Why did they walk away together, calmly, in socks and bare feet, into temperatures that would have killed them within minutes? What caused the group to separate, sending some downhill toward the forest, some back toward the camp, and others deeper into the trees? Why were some hikers able to survive longer, better dressed than those found earlier, if they all left the tent at the same time? What produced injuries typically associated with car crashes or explosions without leaving corresponding damage to the terrain around them? And finally, what explains the radiation detected on clothing when no clear source was ever established? The Soviet investigation closed the case without resolving these contradictions. The site has changed. The names have become familiar. The explanations have multiplied. But the moment that changed everything was never recorded. We've covered the sources, and these are the shadows they leave behind. Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me, you know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.